Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners. In this episode, we are going to be talking about veterans who are in Ukraine. Now, Ukraine gained independence in 1991 as the Soviet Union dissolved. But then in February 2014, Russia occupied and annexed Crimea. Then in February 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine on all sides in a massive escalation of this Russo-Ukrainian war. Joining us for our discussion today is Ivona Kostina. She is the co-founder of Veteran Hub, which is an NGO operating in Ukraine. Ivona is a Kiev-based expert in veterans affairs with 9 years practical experience designing and launching non-governmental programs of support for veterans and also their families. Ivona is also a spouse of a Ukrainian warrior. The insights that she shares with us about this important group of people are really crucial for us to understand. This is the other side of the war and what it's like for ordinary Ukrainian people. Hello, Ivona. It's lovely to have you here with me today.
Hello, Marianne. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting.
And you are, of course, based in Kyiv right now, aren't you? You're speaking to me from Ukraine.
Yes, I'm speaking to you from Ukraine, from Kyiv, from Podil area. I'm actually at Veteran Hub where we do the job right now. And we would have veterans and their family members in the space at the moment.
Amazing. It's really amazing to have you here. And I'm very, very grateful that you're giving us your time. It would be wonderful if you could just tell us a little bit about your background to start us off and say how you began working with veterans.
So I started working with veterans when I was really, really young and very early into the Russian invasion to Ukraine, initially in 2014. I was soon after Maidan, which has traumatized me a lot because my close friend was killed by a sniper there. And this was the first loss I ever encountered of that scale. And it has, as I understand now, from 10 years later, it has traumatized me severely and led to repeated flashbacks and many other mental health consequences that I wasn't aware of and that I didn't have a name for, because generally mental health literacy in the country was very poor back then, and nobody focused on survivors of certain events. It wasn't part of the culture. But fast forward, we had the attack from Russia, and many of the people I knew and for whom I cared deeply, they went to respond to it. And I just found myself asking, like, what can I do to help and how I can be of any use? And soon into the process of volunteering and providing some support that I could, which was not military support, but in any other capacity that could be of benefit, I started noticing some of the fears and experiences that I've lived through after my traumatic experience in people on the front lines and in people who I've been talking to and for whom I cared. I started questioning whether there is anything for those people in the country, and it turned out there was nothing, because we actually didn't have a veteran care system. And that's how I committed myself to doing the job, and I've been here ever since. Through that time, we've managed to build a veteran hub, which is a large national organization that provides services and support to veterans and their families, which does research and analytics and provides all the important data on those people and their experiences to the people who care for them, for the general audience, for the stakeholders who matter. And that's basically my daily life for now. And the one of my team. We're now at almost 130 people around the country and growing, and we're serving thousands of people a year, basically, in our facilities.
Gosh, that's such a moving story in terms of how you have gone from your own personal experience and then just seen that at a larger scale and been able to give back and having that empathy as well for the people who you're helping. It would be, I think, good for people to have more of an understanding, because some people may not really know much about Ukraine or know much about the conflict. And I know it's been a few different stages over the last few decades and years. So it would be really good, I think, if you could just give us a bit of an overview about the history of Ukraine. I know you became independent in 1991, wasn't it? And just tell us a bit about the background and how we got to where the situation is today with you, with this war that you are in the middle of.
So Ukraine is a very, very old nation, but a very young independent state. And our ancestors have been fighting for this independence for many hundreds of years and often lost in the battle, being outnumbered by Russia. It is not our first time trying to fight that independence, but it's probably the first of its length time of independence. And I would say we are benefiting from one of the first generations who didn't live under Russian occupation and thus value the freedom so much. And I am proud to be representative of this generation who never knew Soviet Union and who never lived under it. But of course, being quite a young democracy, independent democracy at the moment, we are only starting to build our system and our way of living. And by system, I mean the system that would serve our values and our server way of living. We have, of course, inherited a large legislative system and a way of thinking from multi-decades under Russian occupation, being what some consider a colony, being occupied and being quite harshly culturally pressured under that occupation, and not being able to establish our own way of thinking and identity towards certain things. And fortunately, that care for veterans and attitude to veterans has fallen through the cracks of that. And under Soviet Union, Ukrainians have served in many capacities in Second World War and after in Afghanistan and another conflict the Soviet Union took part in. But Ukraine also had its resistance and it has its veterans of fighting Russia and Russian occupation and Soviet Union's occupation. So there were a lot of people in the fight, but there was no system of care for those people. And basically, in 1991, what we did is we took everything that was developed for the veterans in the Soviet Union and we just replicated it in our own legislation. And we forgot about it for until 2014.
Can you tell us more about what happened in 2014?
Just for deciding for ourselves and not living under somebody's rule, and all those values that we are trying to build, we went out to the streets to say, no, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. And I want my voice to be counted in such meaningful decisions that would consider my future. And from that started a revolution of dignity, which led to a very severe opposition from the government, opposition from the president's office that actually used force, much superseding what you would usually see in different battle, in different protests. They would use a weapon, they would kill people literally. And we have now a heavenly hundred of people of very different age who were killed throughout January and February 2014. On the streets without being unarmed, being absolutely civilian with no military capacity. They were killed in battle in very uneven force. And after that, our former, not anymore legitimate president fled the country. And at the same time, Russia has invaded and annexed Crimea as one of the parts of Ukraine, and then attacked Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which are two large regions in Ukraine in the east of the country, attacked them and continued their approach to trying to continue waging war there and actually cut those territories off. Then in 2022, they just intensified that and broadened the geography of this attack. But basically, for me and for many people in my country, war started much earlier. It started in 2014, after the Revolution of Dignity and after the annexation of Crimea.
And would you say that it's kind of gone through, does it feel like waves of kind of invasion, or does it feel continuous?
I think that it does feel like waves to a certain extent because we had a break in a form of less intense combat actions. They were actually less intense for some time, but then they intensified so much. I think that for many people in Ukraine, it might feel that the war started in 2022 because it never considered them personally. They weren't affected on a very personal level by the war before that. But the country was, the economy was, the people were, and we have been living in the state for many years. And it's very important to acknowledge that in those 10 years, people have mobilized to serve and demobilized from service. And they had to do the transition that you would typically think about, like the military civilian transition, building up a civilian identity and life during a war. And while the war didn't have a resolution, on their own homeland, deciding to not continue military service, which is a very hard decision to do once your country is at war and you're a warrior, but committing to other priorities in life. And then most of these people, they rejoined service and they were called back from the reserves in 2022. And they continue serving still unless they were wounded or they reached the age, because we have martial law. And that's probably the biggest difference we have since 2022 is the establishment of martial law, which wasn't there before, that gave a lot of additional signs of the war being there, I would say so.
When you say martial law, are you also meaning conscription of people, or is what does it involve, the martial law?
It does involve the, we call it mobilization. It's similar to the conscription, but basically Ukrainian military was also built on the heritage from the Soviet Union, from how Russian military was built as well. And we had conscription, mandatory conscription of younger men for a very long time. However, it was a bad conscription. It didn't serve well. It didn't have a good training program or whatsoever. In theory, it was supposed to train our men to re respond in crisis and to be ready to serve with military and to be called from the reserves. But in reality, many people avoided it and didn't actually join conscription service and weren't prepared to serve. And same as in 2014, same in 2022, a lot of civilians with no military background were called to serve. The only difference is that those who volunteered to serve basically in 2014 and onwards, by 2022, they became the nation's most trained warriors. They became the best warriors we have, those who gone through combat, and they were the ones to be called in the first lines once the crisis hit again with the new force. Of course, both times there were a lot of civilians, and this time as well, we have people who are serving for the first time. We have a lot of breathtaking stories of people who in 2014 were about 10 to 12 years, and they were sending those beautiful postcards, handwritten postcards, to the warriors in the front lines, and some warriors kept them. And now they're finding the people who drew them actually standing in line together with them 10 years later,
Wow.
and keeping the weapons, being children just 10 years ago, and now actually joining the battle. So I would say that since 2014, we have redefined our military completely. But we still rely heavily on the most trained soldiers, basically our combat veterans who got combat experience in the past 10 years. And when we are now building a concept of a national policy, and we have united with four other organizations to do this, we've issued a document, we are focusing the attention of Ukraine's government, as well as international donors supporting this, that basically our veteran policy will consider people who will likely serve once again in their future, because we cannot control whether Russia will or will not attack us once more in the foreseeable future. We cannot control whether there will be another war or won't be another war, but our veterans, our combat veterans, are our only capable military, meaning they will not have the benefit of building this outlook for life and putting down roots in civilian life and investing in all of those beautiful things. And I think it's something quite complex and quite hard to understand, both internally in the country, but also for other countries when they're thinking about Ukrainian veterans affairs. We have had years of trying to adopt a more Western way of thinking about reintegration, about letting people out of the military and them transitioning completely back. But I think that Ukraine will not have the virtue of doing that, and we will need to keep our people, trained people in the reserve, and we will need to plan accordingly to the limitations that we place on their life because of that role to serve them. While they will always have the risk of joining the army once again and losing basically all of their civilian well-being, or at least not being able to invest in it for quite a substantial amount of time. The same would happen for my husband. He is an ATO veteran who served in 2014. He would then build a family and he started a business and he did great in civilian life. He put a lot of effort in restoring his physical and mental health. And then in 2022, he rejoined service and he's there still. He's still in service. He's built a completely different life in the military. He got a new rank. He grew in power and everything. And he got connections. He understands the field. But he's not present in civilian life. And when he comes back, he will have to start from scratch in many, many domains of his well-being. And knowing whether you will have to give it up again will be an important denominator in Ukraine's veterans' lives and journeys for the future.
That's so interesting. I think the idea, I mean, it must be so kind of awful for those soldiers. I mean, in a way beautiful, but in a way horrible, the fact that they would receive these letters from these young people that are now side by side with them. And, you know, I mean, they must have just hoped that this would never continue as many years, and it just keeps continuing. That must be so hard. And I feel like the experience of Ukraine is really interesting, I think, from the perspective of this idea that yeah, you had to call on your people, on the normal civilians who otherwise had very normal lives. It's kind of really challenging, that idea that you have a military, and it's just that the military is involved with war, and it's very separate from civilian life. But in this case, in 2014, it was just normal people who had to suddenly become soldiers and warriors in order to kind of defend against this attack. That feels like something that hasn't happened for a very long time in Europe. And it would be good if you could explain just what was that like? What was that process like of kind of normal people suddenly realizing that they have to join the military, they have to fight, they have to kind of use combat now?
I think that we definitely didn't expect such a turn in our lives. And looking to 2013, many people wouldn't imagine themselves ending up in this situation and in this role. But looking back from where we stand at the moment, I think that our people did really, really well. And they actually adopted this warrior spirit and this new identity really good, as for a completely unprepared nation to do so. We've had it in our past, we've had it in our history because of our geographic positioning, because Russia is far from the first time in trying to destroy Ukraine's culture, identity, nation, and the right for existence. But many of our ancestors have taken up the weapons. I think that this time, the fact that we are the first generation that grew up in freedom, even under influence, and even under constant attempts to influence the way we live, we still had the right to choose, and we had granted by our parents, basically, who fought for it in their own way. And because of that, I think that we stood up and we were able to say no to oppression when it started once again with a new force, and to start defending ourselves. I think that for Europe specifically, it's important to accept that when your homeland is attacked, when you're not fighting for the values overseas, when you're not engaging in global geopolitics, but you're engaging in protecting your homeland, most likely you will not be able to rely only on your military, and you will have to engage a much broader society to just protect yourselves in different capacities. It's not only about becoming warriors, it's also about their families, about caregivers, about service providers, about the mental health and physical health providers, and many, many other aspects of our life. And so, while it was a crisis and while it was hard, I think that because it was protecting your own homeland, it went better than it could have if we just called them for something that wouldn't be as valuable for them personally, which didn't feel as protecting their own livelihoods. And when you're referring to the story about those children who grew up into warriors on that example, and they joined the battle when they could, it's a bittersweet story, to be honest. So on the one hand, of course, understanding that you weren't able to protect them from that experience is horrible. But on the other hand, understanding that those people grew up and joined the battle, and they believe in it, and they believe that it is important, and they are inspired by it, and they take on grown-up roles alongside with more mature people, maybe those who joined earlier, but they take on the role, it actually gives a lot of spirit and a lot of support and a lot of motivation and respect for them. And I myself show a lot of respect for those people younger than me who are now joining the battle and who are undergoing something we went through unprepared. And we honestly take pride in the fact that we were able to prepare a better army for them to serve in. It's definitely a completely different environment, and it's a completely different society. And even the Veterans Affairs system that we now have, and that seems as it has been here forever, it hasn't been here in 2014. And it arose in the past 10 years with the efforts of many, many people who decided to dedicate themselves to it. For those now coming back home to be in a much better condition than we were 10 years ago.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. In In terms of what the war is like for different generations and what it's like to be a kind of veteran as different generations, how could you kind of explain that? I know that there are now many generations involved in the war.
So, because Ukraine called civilians to stand up and fight and to join the military, it called many, many different people from different backgrounds from all over the country. And basically, our military is now highly representative of our society, for the sole exempt of people who are not physically capable to fight anymore because of age or physical health or mental health or their family conditions. Mostly everybody else has a representation in the army. And we thus have a very diverse population of veterans. We have both female and male. We have all types of economic backgrounds in the military. You very unproportionately dis disproportionately spread around the military. Let's put it this way. We have people who've never been out of the military in their grown-up life and have joined 10 years ago as 18-year-olds volunteering to join volunteer battalions and the army and in any capacity, and they are still there. And the only grown-up life they know is one within the military. And for them, probably transition will be hard, and sometimes harder than for many, many others who had some civilian capital and some competencies in civilian life before their service. There are also people who joined in their 50s, basically. Until the age of 60, they can serve legally. They can sometimes serve beyond that age if they volunteer to, but they've joined quite in an older age. We have a lot of people who joined because their sons and daughters were killed in battle and they decided to step in for them. We have those whose relatives went missing or were gotten as prisoners of war and they decided to stand in the battle. We have people from the villages and from the cities. We have IT managers alongside, I don't know, plumbers and different professions. And thus, when we speak about reintegration, we're actually covering the whole society. It's not a controlled track of people entering the army with a similar portrait. It's actually the whole society. And the whole society is now impacted through military service as well, because almost every one of us has somebody in the army and will know somebody personally, which also makes it easier for us to relate to the problem, and even easier now than it was 10 years ago because of the number of people in the military and the number of people who know somebody personally.
So, what proportion of people have served in the military at this point? Is it a large proportion of the population?
So, official number, because like under martial law, data is classified. And so, as an NGO representative, I can tell you only what I hear in the media and from official statements. And what I hear is that before 22, we had officially 680,000 ATO GFO veterans, many of whom who've been called to fight once again on February 24th. And we don't know the proportion, but we think it's at least 70% of this number who have been called back to serve. Just recently, late last year, one of our key military representatives spoke about 1 million to 1,100,000 people in the military at this point. We don't know what share of people of which background are there, but we are looking at this number. We understand that almost everybody of those people has somebody they care deeply for who is considered their partner or loved one. They mostly have parents or children. So multiplying that by three or by four, we have quite a large share of people in the country.
Wow. And as you mentioned, women are serving as well as men. It's mainly men, isn't it? But women are also there. Can you give us a bit of a kind of breakdown around what it's like in the for the genders?
So we have women in the military, and we have been having more and more women in the military since 2014. In 2017, they have been advocating heavily for a law that would enable women to serve in combat capacity. And this law enabled women to grow in rank and in combat role, basically, and take up roles they actually perform. At the moment, they're releasing numbers between 50 and 65,000. I don't remember the most recent number of women in the military, some of whom serve in combat capacity, but I honestly don't remember the share of the people. It's still a minority. It's still a large minority, and mostly military is a male audience in Ukraine. For women, military service isn't mandatory and it's not expected. So you can volunteer, but you wouldn't be called unless you have specific professions that would be considered military reserve, but it's again a very small share of people. But again, even though women like myself don't serve in the military, They take on a lot of roles when their loved ones do. And when one of the couple decided to get mobilized or was mobilized by the government, the other from the couple takes on a lot of additional roles. We did a research called The Journey of the Veteran's Beloved One just last year, and we tried to look at the subjective journey of the spouses and partners, mostly a female audience in Ukraine. And it turned out that since that choice that they have not had no power over, because when we asked them, like, did you try to, were you happy with the decision? Did you try to influence it? They most often answered that I didn't try to influence because I respect my partner and his wishes too much, or I wasn't able to influence because that decision was so firm. And since that decision with no control over was made, which changed their life completely, they had to take on so many additional roles in their life. They had to take care of the security of their family during a full-scale war that affects almost every region. Just this morning, we like had an air raid alert, and it affects you every day. And you have to take shelter. You have to think about all the elderly, all the pets you had together with your family, all the children, and all the dependents you have, both on your side and the husband's or spouse's side. They had to take on management of economics. They are the first caregivers to provide services. So, for example, if something goes wrong and the person gets wounded, the spouse would be, or the mother, or the closest relative would be the one to provide junior physical healthcare services because of a huge shortage of junior medical staff in the country and just the inability of the system to cope with the scale of atrocities that we are having at the moment. And so many of those people take on caregiving roles that are not reimbursed or recognized. But even outside of that caregiving role, they take on so much and they are impacted so much. And at the same time, they're barely recognized. And they somehow don't belong to any of the worlds. They're not civilian and they're also not military. They don't have a community of peers. They live outside of military bases. They were never connected to other spouses. And oftentimes they find themselves completely alone in a very alienating experience while waiting for somebody and in constant worry for their life, because the scale of the fight at the moment and the hardships that our soldiers encounter daily on the front line is so big that for many, from even my community and from the research, we know that those partners, they sleep with their phones on. And for them, one of the signature symbols of war is the sign, you know, when your message is delivered, like when you have the second arrow. This is one of the most powerful signs, because oftentimes when your message is not delivered, it might mean that your loved one is dead or prisoner of war or wounded. And so waiting for that sign to tick is actually one of the most representative experiences you could think about when speaking about the experience of the loved ones. Quite a silent experience, unrecognized, but one of our attempts is to make it visible, to make it recognized, and to start get people talking. I had a very interesting experience. I was giving a lecture to civilian students about experiences of spouses and of veterans, just trying to raise their cultural knowledge. And we talked about this alienation and how your loved ones would distantiate from you once you're waiting for somebody from war, because they have nothing to say and they're so worried and they're afraid. And one of the people in the audience actually texted her friend, and she said, like, "Well, when your husband were mobilized, did you feel that I alienated myself from you? Did you feel I became distant?" And she said, "Yes."
Oh,
And this woman, she came back to us and she said, like, "I would have never thought to ask this question, but it helped me rebuild a connection and to actually start providing some support to this person more proactively, because it actually feels like the world is moving away from you."
wow. Oh my goodness. And this really shows why you're doing the work that you do with the Veterans Hub and the support that you're giving to people. Could you explain a bit more about Veterans Hub, how it started and what kind of support you provide?
So I started with a very small organization called Pobratymy, which I am originally from. We did peer support for veterans, and we tried to get those who were wounded or just out of fighting in 2014, 2015, and to provide them with a peer community and some basic trauma awareness and guiding them to some post-traumatic growth. We did it with the Bodynamic approach that was originated in Denmark, but it was groups of 25 people at most at a time, and we would work with them for 6 months. Very soon, we understood that the scale of the audience is so much bigger than our capacity, and that we would need to scale up as well, and that many other organizations need to scale up the same way with us, and that the journey of veterans and this experience of getting back to normal civilian life that you would like to lead and that you would feel, you know, good living is a long t it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of effort, first of all from the veterans themselves. And we need to build an institution that would support them along the way and be there when they need us and wouldn't be affected by small shortages of funding or changes in the dynamic or in the circumstances and stuff like that. And so we came up with an idea of Veteran Hub as a platform of a large organization that would unite other organizations on its basis and provide veterans with the benefit of being heard. So we put upfront for our service department the value of listening to people, and we allow them to listen to stories people want to share for hours on end, and we wouldn't limit the time any client has here. We provide a basic number of psychosocial services like legal counseling, employment counseling, mental health support, and case management. And this team of people is available daily with no registration or anything. You just show up and you would get information, consultation, you would be heard. But from that, we have understood that we have the benefit of storytelling and we have the benefit of listening to the information people are willing to share. And this means we know our audience. And by that, we try to inform research. We try to dig deeper into the experiences of our veterans, of their loved ones. And we try to, based on that information, identify people who matter and inform them on how to best interact with our audience and to serve them better in their own capacity. So we work with the large community. We work with train attendants, with employers, with police officers, with anybody out there who happens to be on the journey of the veterans and happens to help them in any way. We help them understand the context better. So at the moment, we have two full-scale hubs in Kyiv and in Vinnytsia. It's like 250 to 400 square meter spaces where veterans can come, attend events. They could just sit and take a minute for themselves. They can receive services. They can talk to peers. We also have a trust line, so it's a phone line you can call from a whole country, and it's available daily for consultations of the same kind. We have mobile offices that drive out to rural areas in Kyiv, Vinnytsia, and Dnipro, and they provide psychosocial support on the spot where veterans and their families feel most convenient, and it's mostly targeted at less mobile veterans, not because of health purely, sometimes because of health, but also because of economic barriers, time constraints, shyness, anything that would prevent you from receiving the service in another facility. We also support a network of grassroots organizations called Plus Plus. It's a 9 entry points at the moment around the country in smaller communities where you would have so much established services, and we provide our services there as well. But growing further, we believe that we just have to have a good outreach to our clients to understand the diversity of the problem and to be able to inform as many people in the country as we can reach. So for example, through our projects for employers, it's called Praktika, we help employers build a veteran-friendly policy and to engage veterans back into the workforce once they demobilize. And we currently have 135 partners around the country, which are one of the largest employers. They cumulatively employ over 1 million people, and they study together with us, and we teach their teams, and we give them guidance on how to establish good policies. And so, of course, not every one of their veteran employees will ever come to Veteran Hub. We have just as much capacity as we have. But our work can impact the livelihoods of those veterans, even in the small area of their employment around the country and through other people who care.
Amazing. It sounds like you're doing so much. And I know that you mentioned earlier as well that previously to the wars that you've been dealing with lately, there was no kind of official policy around veterans, or there wasn't a specific way that you approach them. Could you tell us a bit more about kind of historically how you've dealt with veterans and how it's needed to change in recent years?
So Ukraine has inherited its legislation and policy towards veterans from the Soviet Union, which wasn't a policy per se. It was just a number of legislative actions taken towards veterans, and it built on that. So basically in 2014, we made the Soviet legislation available to a new cohort and a new generation of veterans without remodeling, repurposing, rethinking it. Now, with the scaling of the audience, that approach doesn't work anymore. Ukraine cannot afford the scope of benefits that were promised, but almost never in our history actually delivered to veterans. And it has to redefine what support is actually needed and what programming has to take place. Moreover, we need to redefine how we identify a veteran overall, because our current law on veterans, it actually replicates the Soviet law. It was accepted in 1993, and it speaks about veterans as a multitude of audiences, many of whom don't have combat experience and weren't exposed to war. We have Chernobyl liquidators who fall under the same law as veterans of war. We have participants of Revolution of Dignity who fall under the law on veterans of war. And our main call is, at the moment, we've developed this concept of the national policy, we've delivered it to the government, but our call is to redefine and to ensure that veterans as combat participants, as military personnel who has defended the country's interest at a certain time when it was needed, that they get the appropriate support and that they are recognized throughout the multitude of governmental systems and they are provided care. I think that generally we had a long multi-year debate, which wasn't kind of an official debate, but it was happening as a discussion in the field, between the more Western approach and more US approach, I would even say, where you would build a separate system for veterans. But the true poor reality is that when you're fighting a war and most of your resources, over 50% of our own budget of the country goes toward the war, and the war drains you out. And most likely in the next foreseeable future, we will not have time, money, and people to build a separate system for veterans. Moreover, veterans will share so many needs with civilians affected by war that it's just nonsense to build a separate system for them instead of raising the competencies of everybody out there to deal with the same problems. And so our call is to create a multi-ministry approach to engage the whole country in caring for veterans at some capacity as one of their clientele, and to make sure that all of those service providers are aware and keen on the needs and experiences of veterans and the particular specifics in interaction you might want to employ because of their status. It's a very, very long and very deep conversation that started to happen. I think that it's evolutionally very important for Ukraine to have this conversation, because as an independent nation, one of the defining things for me as a citizen is to answer the question, how do we care for those protecting us? How do we recognize them? How do we pay them back? Even though I believe that we cannot pay them back. The sacrifice you make as a warrior, the time you lose and you will never get back, your children growing up and you not seeing them, is something you cannot compensate for. It's not monetary. It's not accountable. It's just something you put down for your community, and it's gone. And I think that it's important to acknowledge, especially when building a policy, that it cannot be purely monetary and it cannot be purely pure exchange. You cannot buy military service. Military service entails some of the sacrifices that are just for the people, and they will be forever gone. I'm sorry for not formulating it completely like properly, you know, as a statement. It is quite a personal issue for me myself, and we are still finding the right words for our own country and trying to put it into the right framing to move forward with and to answer this quite tough question: who do we support, how do we support them, and why do we do that? What do we want to happen as a result of that support?
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying makes complete sense. Just the fact that, as you said earlier, this is mobilization to support your homeland. You know, these people are fighting to save their homeland. So it's very different from overseas situations where you may be quite divorced from the outcome of the military intervention. And as you say, it might be possible within that Western context, if you're sending military over and then they come back, they're kind of almost like a discrete force of people. But when it's so many different elements of the population who are having to go out and fight and then come back again, it's very difficult to untangle that, isn't it, really? It's the whole country, as you say, who are having to be part of this. And it's the whole country that really needs to, yeah, that needs to be supported. And it's every single bit of the infrastructure which is going to be key to that. So I think it makes total sense. In terms of, I know that there's different experiences for people who are veterans at the moment. And you've mentioned as well that I almost associate, there's almost different groups of people, aren't there? Some who've already fought and they've been demobilized, some who fought, they've been demobilized and now they're back in action again. And there are these different kinds of situations for people. Could you give us a bit of an overview about those types of people and what are their experiences at the moment?
We've done a research called The Journeys of Veterans, which replicated in US approach actually to mapping out what happens after the war and giving it names, basically, because usually when we speak about reintegration, we use reintegration rehabilitation. God knows what that means, especially if you're not part of the veteran reintegration field and you're not so much engaged. But we try to give it proper names, like part of transition, what it entails, what people go through, then how, what does it mean to take care of yourself? What does it mean to reinvent yourself and put down roots? And we were doing that after the ATO GFO, and actually our last interview was 3 days prior to the full-scale invasion. So we were kind of harnessing that preparedness to fight if needed, but not yet people back in combat. And what we've seen is that when people were mobilized after 2014 and they've served for, say, a year or two, because 2 years was an average that people engaged in service in some capacity, they then went out and it took them 3 to 5 to 7 years under good circumstances when they had support and networks and everything, and they lived in cities and stuff like that. It took them that time to feel good in civilian life once again, to rebuild their capacity to live in civilian life and to develop it and to have, most importantly, a vision of the future for many years. And we think that it's one of the very distinct things that tell you that a person is actually back in civilian life when they can plan for the future and can see this future for many years to come. And after that, they had to give it up again. They had to fight again. And we know they will have to go through the same journey all over again. They'll again will need 3 to 5 to 7 or more years to start feeling good again. And I think that specifically for the people who will remain in the reserve forces and those who fought twice already in the past 10 years, it will be a very hard decision to make, to commit to civilian life and to actually believe in it again and to put all of that effort, not knowing whether you can sustain it or cannot. In this regard, people who are out of service for life, those who were wounded, those who reached a certain age, they're in a bit better position, I would say, even though they've sacrificed so much, but they know they won't be joining service and they have a certain sense of stability, as much as you can have it during a war, but still without the need to change your life so drastically and engage in service in the future unless you want to. For the rest, who will be able to serve? They, according to our laws, they will remain in the reserve forces, meaning they can be called back again. And we don't know how much time will pass. It might be 5 years until Russia attacks again. It might be 10 years. It might be a third world war. We don't know what the future holds for them. But for those people, this uncertainty of the future will be a very hard condition to overcome to build a good civilian life afterwards. I think that also a very huge difference this time with the full-scale invasion is the time and the intensity of service. For 2 years now, in the third year counting, people have been in very intense combat actions with almost no time to unwind and to change the scenery. And even when they come back to rear regions of Ukraine, they are still in danger. They are still under attack of missiles. And it's still not the peace you would think about. And so I think that this intensity and the fact that in 2 years people build bonds that are lifetime bonds with their peers and seeing those peers being killed in battle, it's a completely different experience than it was in the beginning of the full-scale invasion. Losing a friend and losing a comrade that haven't known for long, though both very traumatic and painful, are different experiences. And we see that people are more exhausted now. And we only have to live and see how this exposure will impact their livelihoods and their health and their future prospects. So, though we know a lot about the journeys of veterans in Ukraine, we know a little about what's to come. And we can start planning, but we will need to see and be very empathetic and be very careful with how we approach things with veteran reintegration when it starts happening on a scale. I think that this year, 2024, is probably the last year Ukraine has to invest in organizational capacity at a large scale to build a system that will serve us for some time. We won't be able to build an ideal system, but we have to invest, and that's what we are prioritizing at Veteran Hub, which comes hard, but it is a priority in my opinion. It's the institutional capacity, the capacity to serve a scaled audience and do it good and maintain the quality. Because next year, regardless of demobilization, that just for contextual knowledge, Ukraine during martial law doesn't have a law on demobilization. So people cannot get demobilized as long as we're under martial law. And in April, they are supposed to be voting a law that would provide some clarity on demobilization prospects and on mobilization of new recruits. allowing to mobilize a new wave of replacement, basically, for the soldiers. And this law hasn't had its final wording yet, and it's still being debated in parliament, but it will provide understanding of the future prospects for a large part of Ukrainian veterans, and we are waiting for that a lot. But regardless of that demobilization happening or not happening next year, we will have a critical mass of veterans back in the rear. We will have a large number of wounded, a large number of released from prisons, and people just reaching the age of 60 or getting into some family circumstances to put a huge strain on all service provision we have in the country already. And unfortunately, most of the service providers are not ready for that scaling of the audience, us included. And just hoping that all the efforts we're putting this year will pay us back next year with some stability as we start dealing with the real demand that we are expecting.
And what are the kind of personal challenges that veterans face as they come back into civilian life and try and live a what was a normal life?
I think that there is no coming back, as you would imagine it. So you would probably feel as a as if you lived abroad for some time and then you came back home, and everything has changed a little. And I like the metaphor of your old clothes in your wardrobe. You know, you try to put them on yourself, but they don't fit anymore, and they don't look good at you anymore. And you've changed so much that that previous life just doesn't fit. Your wardrobe doesn't fit on you. And I think that the first stage is seeing those differences and meeting the differences between who you are and how you used to live and what you used to care for, and meeting those conflicts day by day in trying to fit in and to rebuild your schedule, rebuild your life, to understand and orient basically what to do now and what transport do I use, what food do I buy, and stuff like that. And it goes gradually from that. People start seeing chronic conditions that they didn't pay attention to or they didn't notice because of adrenaline and many other things happening to them in at war. They come back and time passes and they start seeing weight changes. They start seeing mental health conditions. They start seeing simple physical health conditions such as traumatic brain injuries that went undiagnosed, unnoticed, and then they give chronic conditions several years later. And those physical health conditions make their life worse, and they have to start treating themselves. And they prioritize their own health, their needs, their space. They start reestablishing their space once again. What we see then happening is gradually coming to reinventing yourself, what we call it, is basically trying out new things and finding what fits now in this new identity, in this new reality, trying to integrate your military experience, trying to think of it as part of your identity, but not the definitive part of your identity, just one of it, and just to find sense for it and how to live with it moving forward. That comes with changing jobs, with changing environments, with talking to new people, with trying to establish new connections, with losing some connections with your peers because of distance and because of different livelihoods that you're living as civilians. And then what we saw among veterans is putting down roots, is establishing something stable, something you would commit to, and sticking to it and building long-term connections, which is a good sign for us. And it means that the person will most likely not need services anymore. And we're expecting new veterans to come through the same processes. They are hardened by bureaucracy. They are hardened by all the statuses and benefits and material stuff, like not having enough money to go through transition, not having enough time to rest after service, not having enough access to medical and physical services and stuff like that. But with or without services, veterans will still be adjusting to their new life after service. And again, knowing that at any point after all your effort, you can start from scratch all over again and go back to the military will be a hard truth to face. And it will, I think, lead to many people considering military as a job for the rest of their life, because it will be safer unless we resolve the war. And this is tragic for me because those are a lot of talented people who gave up a lot of civilian endeavors that have enriched our community. And I believe that they can contribute once again. And if we bring their brains back and we give them the conditions to create and to contribute and to portray their talents here in civilian society, we will be enriched so much. And it would make me to think that they will forever be contributing only to the military. But I understand that for some, it will just be a safer option because they then can stick to some investments they've made into themselves, into their careers, into their knowledge, into their position in society that would be easier for them to hold on to.
Yeah, I think it's so difficult, isn't it? Because you can, there's a certain gritting of teeth that you have to do if you're involved in a very, very highly stressful environment, such as being in war, and then to kind of gradually let your guard down, gradually realize, feel like, that you can relax and you can be part of normal life again. You have to, it's a vulnerability thing to do that, and then to then have to suddenly go right back to where you were in what must be incredibly traumatic is a kind of trauma in itself, isn't it? This kind of backwards and forwards movement between what is normal, what is war, and that kind of thing. And you can imagine that it would feel like you're more in control of the situation if at least you just know, you know, your life is going to be this military life, and then you don't get your hopes up almost that it couldn't be something different.
Maybe I'm too romantic at this point, and I acknowledge that in the fact that I am partially biased in this regard, but I believe that we can shape the narrative differently, even for ourselves, to build more realistic expectation of what the future holds and to have more capacity to live through it. And I believe that if we are honest about the prospects of serving again, and if we put that as part of a plan that might happen, it makes it easier to build your life around that. I think that the biggest problem of our veterans affairs in the past 10 years is that we made an assumption that this will never happen. They will never have to serve again. And we put so much effort in helping them build that civilian life and didn't speak openly about this risk and about how to be ready for it and about how to make your family unit ready for it, your work unit ready for it, even if it never happens. And I think that now we have to be more realistic and we have to be more honest and we have to plan accordingly to reality that we will be facing. And I have this inner feeling that Ukrainian warriors can adapt to that. They have shown this adaptability. They have shown us that they can survive and be in pretty good mental and physical health condition, be able to cope with the very harsh circumstances and not necessarily spiral back and then only heal for the rest of their life. They can continue serving, but they need support and they need to be honest for themselves, first of all, about the prospect that they will be having. And that is probably the job of the government here.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think you can prepare if you have realistic expectations. Some of the work that you mentioned that you've done, you obviously started off working with veterans, but then you realized that you also wanted to work with the families, and the families also had specific needs, and also there were needs relating of the veteran to relate better to their families as well. And you've been doing some work around that. Could you tell us a bit more about that work that you've been doing to help integrate the veterans with their families again?
So we're not per se working on integrating veterans with their families. We're treating families as a separate audience for us who's been affected by war in very different way than civilians. We started doing this because in 2022, when the full-scale invasion broke out, literally from the first hours, veterans would go back to military commissariats. They would enlist again. They would join service. But it was such a huge crisis for such a large part of the territory and for so many people that family members had to flee and evacuate and take care of the safety of their families without their military loved ones who joined the military and had to give up their family's safety over the country's safety, which was a hard choice of itself, but it happened. And we started receiving calls on all numbers available in the organization concerning the family's well-being. Those were families calling, but those were also the military calling and saying, like, my wife is in this city and she's trying to reach a bus for evacuation. How can she do it? My family is there. My family is under occupation. My family has evacuated abroad and doesn't know English. There were so many requests that we had to set up an online consultation unit and we had to redirect all of our employees who were also evacuating, who were also undergoing the same thing. Our team has been mobilized for 30% of the staff that we had. From key positions, they went fighting, and we had to like deal with all of that and set up a consultation unit and everything. But we started seeing all those requests, and we actually did a research on the journeys of those people, of the spouses, of the family members. And now we see that they're not recognized by the government nor by the civil society. They don't have targeted services for them, and we're trying to tackle that. So for us, the spouse is an equal client to the veteran. We try to treat to their mental health, to their part of the story. We are not teaching them to be good spouses. We hate this part of the narrative. Like, how do you talk to your veteran spouse? You talk to him as a human, but you first acknowledge what you're going through and how much you have actually lived through in the past years, even if you were not in official service. And then we provide peer support, we provide mental health support, many, many other things. And we're trying to raise awareness in the government and in general society that spouses are a subject audience requiring separate services, requiring separate communication, separate care from day one and all the way through demobilization and transition, and basically for as long as they're affected by that experience. It is a hard conversation because it means that we have to add people in need of care and support to the whole number of people who are already needed care support. But it is also part of an honest dialogue. Like, they already need this support. They already go through this experience. They already contribute to the well-being of their military spouses so much, and they take on so many roles that it's just our job to acknowledge and treat for that and to provide them with what they have earned, basically, and what they need.
And you mentioned a couple of projects that you're working on around intimacy and children as well. Could you say a bit more about the projects that you're working on currently?
Oh, so at the moment we're working with the police officers, and we're trying to deal with three main issues: is the police interaction with veterans in the field in different situations they might encounter. We already see situations like veterans with traumatic brain injuries who might seem drunk, for example, but they are not drunk. They just have problems with their vocabulary because of their traumatic brain injury, or they have tremor or other symptoms that might seem alike, and they might not be wearing uniforms, and they are misinterpreted those symptoms for drunkenness or other substance abuse. We see other conflict situations, and we're trying to mitigate that those by educating ourselves on what's happening and educating the police officers on how to react more ethically. We're also looking into the system of suicide registry and suicide prevention veterans, and also informing police officers on ethical behaviors on scene and how they can try and prevent suicide when it's preventable. It's not always preventable, unfortunately, as it turns out. We also work with the police as an employer, and we try to foresee how the police would engage veterans as employees and what would that entail for Ukrainian police services and for the veterans. We also work on Praktika. It's a project for employers looking at specifically construction and development and also at outdoor scenes for work. We're also doing a project in mental health literacy for veterans called It's Okay. It basically normalizes whatever's happening with you and helps you understand where you can get support. It's a media digital tool that we have developed. We're also looking into conscious parenting. We've released a guidebook for military families on starting a family and maintaining relationships as new parents with planning pregnancy, labor, and first year postpartum. For mostly spouses, female spouses remaining in the rear while their loved ones are serving. And we distributed those through maternity wards and through OBGYNs to make sure they reach the right audience and help them get support in this very vulnerable condition and taking care of their family on their own while their loved ones are serving and might encounter a lot of hardships in their lives. And we also did last year a project on sex and intimacy for wounded veterans. So we're trying to look at meaningful relationship building experiences in veterans, particularly, and to help them start and mitigate these dialogues with the people they love or that care for them. Veteran Hub acts as a consultant in client service development. So, for example, we consult our largest railway, our only and largest railway provider, on how to ethically support veterans on their journey, and we will be informing the train attendants across the country on how to ethically interact with our audience. We're looking at taxi drivers. So it's quite a large community, but we're trying to break it down to smaller proportions and to inform all of those and engage with them and see how the relationships is being formed and how we can help that relationship flourish a bit better.
Amazing that you're doing so much, and yeah, as you said, kind of so varied as well, but it all counts, doesn't it? So that sounds really, really great. I mean, yeah, I'm very impressed by everything that you're doing, and at the same time, you're doing it in this context of continuing violence. Thank you so much. What does the future hold for Veteran Hub? What are the kind of the next steps?
So, as I mentioned, our key goal for this year is like we've doubled in size since last year in the number of people working for us. And now the task is to make sure that we maintain quality and we are stable enough to meet the growing demand of our clientele. We are preparing for expansion and we're looking for resources for expansion to new regions and to establish new client entry points to provide more services to the people who need them. And we're also building an internal think tank, which is the very new endeavor, but it's much needed to help us institutionalize those approaches to working with data and information, knowledge about our clients' experiences. Our main focus is contextual knowledge about their livelihoods, experiences, and needs. And we are a translation tool. We translate those for many, many other people in a very convenient and understandable language to make sure that they hear the key message they need to about the experience and the connection they have with the veterans. So those are the main goals for us. We estimate that the number of requests will be continuing to grow. And so we are in search for resources for that, and both human resources, financial resources, and also just organizational capacity to be able to do the work well.
And if people want to find out more about Veteran Hub or support your work financially or in any other way, how can they do that? And where can they maybe follow you on social media?
Well, we're everywhere. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, with quite different audiences. I'm not sure if we're on TikTok, but I think we are. I'm not there, so I'm not following Veteran Hub, but I believe my colleagues have put us up there. We're also on Twitter. We have a website called veteranhub.com.ua. It is unfortunately only in Ukrainian now. We will be working towards an English version later in the future, but Google Translate will help you. It's not a complicated website. We do accept donations through our official bank accounts, which also can be found on our website.
Brilliant. And we can put all of that in the show notes so that people can go and find you there easily. Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. And yeah, as I said, you're doing amazing work and in such difficult circumstances. So you're doing brilliantly. And thank you so much for explaining what's going on for you and the veterans and their families and everybody in Ukraine. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for paying attention to this topic. And it was a pleasure speaking to you both now and in preparation for the podcast recording.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic, and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.